From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Cybersecurity and Internet Freedom. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Stuxnet, a computer worm, was used to disrupt Iran's nuclear program. China made use of social networks in its attack on Google. Now defenders of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks have launched denial-of-service attacks on Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, and Amazon. Institutions, including governments, are on the defensive, and they're trying to beef up cybersecurity. But how does cybercrime happen? Is it all technology, or is the human element just as important? Will cybersecurity mean suppressing free speech? On Reporter's Notebook later on, UN climate negotiations are described as barely alive. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. The Internet is now essential to the global economy, to the military, and to politics. But users are vulnerable to attacks from the inside as well as the outside. Today, we'll talk with one of America's most notorious cyber criminals, now a security consultant, and to others about cybersecurity. On Reporter's Notebook, forget another international agreement to replace the Kyoto Protocols. Climate change will now be addressed by a patchwork of solutions agreed to by individual nations. First, this news update. With the lame duck Congress still facing a mountain of work, senators who agree with each other are squabbling among themselves, and House Democrats have picked a fight with President Obama. Anyone watching could be excused for being completely confused. That's according to Michael Shear with the New York Times, also the chief writer of the paper's caucus blog. Good to have you on our program.
Sure. Happy to be here.
The filibuster has become sort of a procedural matter, but we have a couple of senators on the floor today, apparently, the independent Bernie Sanders and Mary Landrieu of New Orleans, who have taken it back to its original meeting, talking as long as they can.
Indeed. You know, I've got C-SPAN on in the room here, and you just sort of see Senator Sanders there up talking and talking. So what is usually, as you said, just a procedural tool into something that actually has some meaning again.
Apparently, he's got a couple of books with him, and he seems to be ready to go as long as he can. He says you can call it a filibuster or if you want, or you can call it a very long speech. But what he's angry about is the deal that the president made with the Republicans.
Right. It's a sort of visual and vocal expression of the liberal rage that's really been expressed all week, in the House and in the Senate, among the Democratic Party at what they feel is a real premature caving by the president to the Republican demands, and including some things that really the Democrats all year long have been campaigning against, the estate tax and the extension of tax cuts for millionaires.
And then you have a don't ask, don't tell. Now you see it. Now you don't.
Right. I mean, what a confusing situation. I wrote about this on our website today. I mean, what a confusing situation, you know, sort of votes that were going to happen, then they weren't going to happen, then they were scheduled again, then they were delayed. And then just as we all thought, we sort of were, not going to see anything happen, there was the Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, on the floor of the Senate saying, okay, let's vote. And they did. And it went down. And so then you had to sort of scratch your head and wonder, well, if he knew it was going to fail, why did he bring it up for a vote in the first place?
Well, now I understand there's a possibility that a new version of it is being presented.
Right. So it failed, and just as soon as we were ready to write it off, a new version, one that will be a standalone bill as opposed to the previous one, which had been attached to a defense spending measure, the standalone bill may in fact be considered sometime in the coming days and weeks.
Apparently, they had the votes for it, but they got involved in another procedural argument having to do with that tax deal.
Right. You know, that's the thing about the Senate is that the procedures often muck up the substantive work, and so Republicans have said from the beginning here over the last couple of weeks they will not do anything substantively until the tax fight is over until they have are convinced that that's in law. And so that's not done yet. It looks like a vote may happen on Monday. And until that happens, they're sort of holding everything else up.
What about the tax deal? Are they going to vote on that before they have to vote on anything else? Are the Republicans going to get that?
Well, it looks like, this filibuster aside, it looks like the vote on the tax package, this compromise that the president reached with the Republicans, looks like the vote is heading perhaps as early as Monday. You could have debate all through the weekend, conversation and debate all through the weekend. If it happens on Monday, if the Senate were to pass it, which is, I think, what folks mostly expect, then it would have to go to the House. Of course, the House has been more problematic for the president because you've had this real serious expression from many of the Democrats there of opposition. And in fact, they took a vote, a private behind closed doors vote in their caucus to say, look, we're going to oppose even bringing this to the floor. So they've got to deal with that first. It looks like you could have by midweek, potentially some resolution on that.
In the meantime, we've got the START Treaty on nuclear weapons, and we've also, don't we have continuing resolutions or some mechanism for keeping the government functioning? They haven't passed any appropriations bills, have they?
Oh, yes. The government, you got to keep that running, too. Shoot. but, yes, they expect to probably get to that at the very end. It's often the last thing they do before they leave. There's not sort of much disagreement that at this point on either side that you have to sort of pass a resolution to keep things open. The START Treaty is more problematic, not because there's really all that much doubt that there's the votes to pass it. They need 67 votes to pass to essentially approve the treaty in the Senate, but there's some Republicans that are saying, look, we want a fulsome debate. We want a week-long debate on that. And so, with all of the things you've mentioned already, it's sort of jamming everything together and trying to find the time to do it all. The one possibility that's out there that nobody likes particularly is that you could save something like the treaty and come back in that week between Christmas and New Year's and perhaps get things done then. But of course, as you can imagine, there's not a whole lot of folks on Capitol Hill who think that's a good idea.
Spoil a lot of vacations if you do that. Michael Scheer, again, with the New York Times, chief writer for the paper's caucus blog. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Sure.
In a moment, cybersecurity and internet freedom. On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. This has been the biggest year ever for cybercrime. From Stuxnet, the worm that damaged Iran's nuclear development, to China's attack on Google, and now to the shutdowns of commercial websites by defenders of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. That's according to Joe Menn. He's author of Fatal Systems Error, The Hunt for the New Crime Lords Who Are Bringing Down the Internet. He's a reporter covering cybersecurity for the Financial Times. Joe Menn, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about these things individually for a minute, if we can. Which of them, or how do they work, which of them would appear to be the most devastating?
Well, the thing that's the biggest game changer is Stuxnet. Stuxnet is the first time that a self-propagating computer program caused physical damage in the real world. There was actually a time in the early 1980s when the U.S. Stuck a bit of a bug inside some computer code that they knew that the Russians were going to steal, and it succeeded in blowing up the Trans-Siberia pipeline. And that was fairly impressive and didn't get noticed until about 10 years later when somebody's memoirs came out. but Stuxnet is beyond that. It hit not just Iranians, the Iranian nuclear enrichment program, but a number of other plants. And it's really impressive. It has apparently destroyed numerous centrifuges.
Yep.
That is conventionally believed to be the work of a nation state. We don't know which one. The short list includes people who are really mad about Iran's nuclear program and have pretty good cyber war capability.
So that would be Israel and the United States, conceivably.
They would be on the list, yeah.
Yeah. And what it does, I take it, is actually go into the hardware produced by Siemens, the German industrial giant and change the program. Is that right?
Well, close, not quite. First of all, to get there, it has to do a number of steps, and it did them all very different sorts of programming. They all did very well. Just to find the Siemens software, which is what it's looking for, it first used three or four, depending on your count, unknown vulnerabilities in Windows. It then got in, and it spreads not over the Internet, which makes it unusual, but spreads via flash drives and then internal networks within a given factory, which is what it's looking for. So it does all this fairly impressive heavy lifting just to get into a Windows machine, and then it ignores the vast, vast majority, 95-99% plus, of Windows machines, because it's only looking for those few machines that happen to run Siemens software that is controlling a certain kind of process inside a factory or other industrial facility, and then it's looking, and then within that, it looks for a specific setup that we think only would hold true in the event of if it's a Iranian nuclear facility, and then it tweaks those settings and covers up what it did.
Okay,
it's really impressive.
So Stuxnet, as you say, is a game changer. What about the attack by China on Google? How was that accomplished?
That's very interesting. Not so much that it happened, but that it was disclosed. In fact, this is part of what is absolutely routine Chinese-sponsored penetration of major Western technology companies looking for their intellectual property, in this case, Google's source code. What was unusual is that Google went public with it and drew great attention to it and, in fact, threatened to pull out and did partially pull out of China. They could do that because it's run by three guys who've got all the votes. Most publicly traded companies, the shareholders would have the CEO's head on a platter if they threatened to pull out of the world's largest Internet market. But what was interesting about that is that they used social media, which is one of the great one of the many reasons why cybersecurity is getting so much worse. More effort went into the what's called social engineering than into the actual coding, which again used undisclosed flaws in Microsoft products, in this case Internet Explorer. What they did is they identified probably more than one, but at least one Google engineer that had access to things that they wanted. They looked at that person's social circle, compromised one of that person's, one of his friend's accounts, and then sent him an instant message via Microsoft Messenger with a link. And because the guy thought it was coming from a friend, he clicked on the link, and that launched the zero day without him knowing it, and then they had access.
So he was tricked then on social media.
Right.
What about the denial of service attacks that have been deployed by Anonymous and Operation Payback having to do with WikiLeaks and Julian Assange?
Okay, so this is again sort of coming from a different place. In some ways, it might say more about the future of sort of grassroots activism. But let me say at the outset that the folks at Operation Payback, this very very loose anarchic group called Anonymous, are not a bunch of skilled spy wizards with PhDs from MIT. They are by and large teenagers and young men who are big fans of cartoon porn and stealing music. Their previous incarnation of Operation Payback was aimed at the Record Industry Association of America and folks like that, and then they just decided that maybe WikiLeaks would be a good thing to defend as well. So they've launched these denial of service attacks, which are actually fairly easy to do, and you don't need great technical sophistication, because most of these folks are not hackers at all, really, against folks like MasterCard, Amazon, and Visa that have withheld, that have dropped services that they were offering to WikiLeaks. This is kind of a revenge thing. And they've been, modestly successful. What's interesting to me, though, is that in the same way that WikiLeaks has sort of democratized the spread of information, whether it's good or bad, that's what's happened. There's a lot more information before a lot more people. Now the tools of Internet protest, whether you like them or not, are much more user-friendly and have spread more widely. In the past, denial of services have been used by criminal groups and by governments to suppress dissenters on the Internet. But now it seems like pretty much anyone can get in on the action if they feel like it with a few clicks.
So what do we do about this?
Well, what I hope is that it will, first of all, reinvigorate the discussion about Internet security as a whole, which is a disaster. And that does not necessarily mean great government, big brother control of everything. It may mean, to my mind, I mean, I've been working on this stuff for more than a decade now as a journalist, and I hope it means that more money and more effort goes into more secure internet protocols, be it the entire suite known as TCP/IP. There's some seed funding from DARPA and others on more secure systems for communicating, or bits of it, the DNS part, the BGP part. All of those have huge flaws, and hopefully there'll be more serious concerted effort to address those.
Joseph Mann again with the Financial Times. Kevin Mitnick first began hacking in his early teens. He served 5 years in prison for wire and computer fraud. He's been the subject of a movie, and he wrote a book called The Art of Deception. He now runs Mitnick Security Consulting, and he shows companies how to harden their computer systems and also how to test the human factor. Kevin Mitnick, I know you're tired. You have had a long flight, and you've been kind enough to get up and talk to us, and thanks very much for being on our program.
It's my pleasure. Hopefully I'll make sense since I'm pretty jet lagged. But go ahead.
what are the prospects for cybersecurity, the kind that we've just heard described by Joseph Mann, and anything else?
Well, I agree with him that there's definitely issues with protocols such as BGP. You know, there's been major bugs found in DNS that are being addressed. And there's always going to be bugs. I mean, you're talking about millions of lines of code. Programmers make mistakes. Vulnerability researchers find those mistakes, and then eventually, bad actors find those mistakes and then exploit them. And then companies have to patch them, and companies have to harden their systems. So even if they're compromised, the attacker doesn't get too far. But usually, with the type of exploits that are found, or vulnerabilities rather, like Stuxnet, like what you were talking about earlier in the program, there is really no workaround. So it's a constant arms race. It's constant back and forth. You have people finding vulnerabilities and exploiting them, and then you have companies fixing them, and it just continues in this cycle.
What about the human element that you've talked about?
Oh yeah, I mean, even like in the WikiLeaks case, okay, allegedly Bradley Manning lifted a lot of secret cables from CIPRNet, the government's secret internet, and he apparently, used a little bit of a social engineering trickery by placing all these classified cables, if you will, onto a CDR labeled Lady Gaga, as if it was music. And that's how he was able to, effectively smuggle out these cables from his post at the military. So it's kind of has a social engineering component to it. But all the attacks today, most of the attacks on systems are what we call client-side attacks. They're attacking the desktop software that sits on your computer, and all those have require an element of social engineering to dupe a user into doing something that lets the attacker take advantage of that vulnerability in that desktop software. For example, there's been a lot of vulnerabilities identified with Adobe Acrobat, PDF files. So there were several ways to booby trap PDF files and send them to a particular target. And then as soon as that target opens that file, it does bad things, because what that vulnerability allows the attacker to do is run their own programming instructions. So the social engineering component of that is trying to dupe somebody into opening that PDF. And that's not really too hard these days, because if the attacker does a little bit of research and determines relationships that companies and employees have with, vendors, partners, and customers, it's not too difficult to use a social engineering attack to get that person to open up the PDF file. Once that PDF file is open, it exploits the vulnerability in Adobe Acrobat, and then the attackers into that system. So a lot of the attacks today all have a social engineering component. I wrote a book on social engineering back in 2002, and it seems like social engineering is more prevalent today than it was when I was a hacker 15 years ago.
Well, how do you feel about this? You've done time for this kind of thing. You're now in the cybersecurity business. Do you have to admire Stuxnet, for example? And how do you feel about these young protesters who have perpetrated these denial-of-service attacks because of what they see as a challenge to the freedom of WikiLeaks and the Internet?
I think those guys are, you know, stupid. I think it's very immature and malicious to do denial of service attacks, and these businesses had you know, are basically under attack from these probably kids, probably 14 to 16 years old, that, you know, find a piece of software on the internet that allows them to do denial of service attacks. I mean, it's so simple, and you need no, and there's no skills necessary to do it. Obviously, I'm not proud of the proud of those individuals. Now, Stuxnet, on the other hand, was ingenious. I mean, the development and the trickery that these actors had used were pretty astounding. And I don't think it was the work of a lone person. I think it probably was the work of a nation state or some sort of very sophisticated development team, because the way the worm actually worked was by exploiting, you know, 4 zero-day vulnerabilities. And zero-day means, you know, that the vulnerabilities were newly discovered and were not addressed by the software manufacturer. And then just the cleverness in how this whole attack on the Siemens equipment was done, and how this worm searched out for Windows computers that would communicate with this particular type of Siemens equipment. And just the entire sophistication behind it was very impressive. You know, I'm not impressed that they, were trying to disrupt an industrial complex. I'm really impressed by the programming behind it. And the social engineering that was behind it is they actually had broken into, I think it was a credit union, and was able to command one of the employees' computers and then email a cert provider, a certificate provider, and request a code signing cert. A code signing cert is where a company could request a certificate and they could sign programs. So when people run those programs, they could decide whether they're going to trust those programs based on who signed them. And so what the developers of Stuxnet did was actually use social engineering to get a cert issued to some random company and then sign the code so it would be trusted. So there was social engineering involved and technical wizardry, and it was just very impressive.
So once again, then, there are these two elements, the technical wizardry and the social engineering. Do they always seem to be present? Is that always part of it?
Nowadays, you know, there's always a component of social engineering and malware. Usually, you know, 95%.
Okay. So, Kevin Mitnick, excuse me, we need to go to a break. We'll come back, talk further with Kevin Mitnick, Joseph Men, and others on our Reporter's Notebook a bit later. What's left of the UN Conference on Climate Change? Tell us what you think on To The Point Facebook page. Back in a moment with To The Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Norman Olney back with To The Point, talking about cybersecurity, talking with Kevin Mitnick at the moment, a former cyber criminal, now in the cybersecurity business. When it comes to Stuxnet, both you and Joseph Men indicated that this is a game changer. The question then would be, could you, Kevin Mitnick, do you think, had you been working as a security consultant in the right place, have been able to stop that, or is this something that nobody had ever thought of before?
Well, no, it was pretty unstoppable because, again, they were exploiting vulnerabilities that would have compromised anybody even running, you know, the latest Windows 7 operating system, and they were using, you know, zero-day vulnerabilities. So, for example, if a company has a public-facing site and they're running Apache or IIS and there's a zero-day vulnerability in that web server software, I mean, it's very difficult to mitigate any type of security risk because you just don't know it exists. So what businesses will try to do is try to mitigate, like, if an attacker is able to compromise that internet-facing site, how do you control what they can get to on the inside of the network? So it's kind of like, you know, having to it's building blocks. So basically, the attacker tries to compromise an internet-facing site and then worm their way into systems in the internal network or other systems in what they call the DMZ, which is the demilitarized zone. And what businesses need to do is, you know, kind of have a defense in depth strategy that if an attacker is successful using, for example, a zero-day vulnerability or other types of methodologies, that they are able to mitigate the ability of the attacker to spread through the network. But to protect that system that's internet-facing, that's extremely difficult if there's a vulnerability that's not known and not patched.
Okay. We've talked about cyber crime. We've talked a bit about the political relevance manipulating the internet when it comes to WikiLeaks. What about the military? James Lewis is Senior Fellow and Director of the Commission on Cybersecurity at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's also the primary author of a recently released report called Securing Cyberspace for the 44th Presidency. James Lewis, good to have you on our program.
Thanks.
You said this turned out to be a pretty popular report, I take it.
Yeah, a lot of people, including a lot of my friends in China, have all read it. So I don't know if that's good or bad, but a lot of people have looked at it.
40,000 copies downloaded?
Yep.
And not the usual thing you would expect to be a bestseller.
We're always happy when we can sell 12 copies here at a think tank. So, yeah, it was a big surprise.
Okay, what about this? How important is cybercrime, cyber subversion, and what can be done about it?
You know, the main thing we've got going on is two political trends on the internet. The politics of the internet, the vision that the people who created it had of a self-organizing community that would be self-policing, it just doesn't work. And there's two results of that. The first result is kind of the WikiLeaks result. You've got the ability to hide behind the internet and do things like these denial-of-service attacks and these anonymous political comments. The second thing that's happening is the U.S. is being challenged around the world. People want a more secure internet, and they're going to try and find it whether we like it or not.
Is there going to have to be international cooperation?
Yeah, there's already efforts to get international cooperation underway in different places, in the UN, in the ITU, in some of the other organizations. One of the problems we have is that for a long time, the U.S. refused to engage. The U.S. refused to talk to other countries. And so the game has moved in a way we may not like, and we're playing catch-up.
What do you think is there some sort of missing link here? You talked about the people who started the internet and saw it as a self-organizing, a self-policing. Is there something that they failed to foresee and consequently didn't do?
Yeah, they never expected this was going to be a global network that hundreds of millions of people would use. It was designed for a small community of researchers. You've heard about some of the technological flaws. The technologies we're using were built in the 1970s in many cases, and they do need to be fixed. And, you know, DARPA has a little seed money, but we need to do more. The biggest problem, though, is political, right? The biggest problem is that the rules that apply to a research toy don't make sense for a global infrastructure.
Well, there's one term that's come up, which is user attribution. What does that mean?
What it means is that when you use the internet in the early days, you know, there was a small number of, I used it in 1984 for the first time, and, you know, everyone knew I was at the University of Chicago, and other people were at, you know, Caltech or someplace like that. You didn't have to worry about who was on the other end. Nowadays, of course, it could be anyone, and the famous New Yorker cartoon, we've all seen it, you know, no one knows you're a dog. That turns out to be an almost fatal error, the fact that we did not think about how to make it easier to identify folks when they get on the internet.
So is anonymity then a primary a flaw of the internet?
You know, people are going to say that you need anonymity for political reasons. I don't know if that's true, but you're going to hear it. I think that you have to say in some circumstances, yeah, people want to be anonymous. There's things you're going to want to do on the internet. Everyone immediately thinks porn, but what I actually mean is maybe you'll want to look for a medical condition, or maybe you'll want to look for a medicine and you don't want your employer or insurer to know about it. That's perfectly legitimate. But for political activity, for business, for trade, we should be able to identify who you are.
How do you do that? How do you accomplish that? Make sure that nobody can be anonymous if under circumstances like that?
It's going to be very difficult, and we've been trying for more than a decade and haven't made any progress, right? There are not it's not a technological problem, and one of the things that is dogging us in this whole discussion of cybersecurity is people still tend to revert to, silver bullet technology and we'll fix the thing. This is not a technological problem. It's a political problem. And people have talked about maybe two internets. I think that's a little crazy. Maybe some functions where you have to have a really strong credential, you know, like a token or maybe your fingerprint or an iris scan. Other functions where you don't need to identify yourself. So it'll take us a while to sort this out. On the scale of things, having tried now for 15 years and not having made it work, that's not too bad.
I used the wrong term. The term is user authentication. You knew what I was talking about, and
right.
Maybe you didn't notice what I said. Anyway, I want to make sure our listeners do. User authentication
is
issued.
Oh, I thought you were just being fancy. Yeah.
Let me go to Mark Rotenberg. He's president of EPIC. That's the Electronic Privacy Information Center, a group that is based in Washington. He testifies before Congress on emergency privacy and civil liberties issues such as we're dealing with now. Mark Rotenberg, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be with you.
What about the threat to freedom of speech if, in fact, there is a major effort to require user authentication? Is that something you're worried about?
Well, I think it's a serious issue. It was a matter that came before the House Science Committee earlier this year, and I spoke with that committee about this, based partly on a report that had been issued by the National Research Council. And, you get experts in a room, and some people would say if we could do a better job of user authentication, we might be able to, identify and perhaps prevent some of these cyber attacks. But you'll also get other experts who will say that user authentication is always imperfect and in some circumstances can actually be exploited. In other words, once you have a system that relies on untrusted users, the very smart attackers will exploit that trust to get access that they might not otherwise get. So I think it's correct to say that this is not a silver bullet. And then you have to consider also some of the downsides. And the downsides can fall in the realm of political speech, where you have people who are seeking to have their views known on the Internet. They may be based in countries where their views are not popular. They may be dissidents and journalists and others. And for them, identification is actually a very scary prospect. So we've also tracked the use of identification techniques by governments, not so much for the purposes of cybersecurity, but rather to try to discourage political dissent.
So, in other words, governments then have misused user authentication?
Well, it's our view that it certainly can be misused. And interestingly, here in the United States, we have not only our strong First Amendment tradition, but in fact the Supreme Court has said in a whole series of cases the critical to the First Amendment right in the U.S. is the right of anonymity. So the U.S. Supreme Court has actually held in several cases that the governments cannot, for example, require authors of political pamphlets to put their name on the pamphlet. They can't even require someone who's going door-to-door soliciting for a cause to reveal their actual name. So that connection between anonymity and freedom of expression is actually one that traces its roots right back to the Federalist Papers and the founding of this country.
Mark Rotenberg at EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Let me go back to our first guest, Joseph Menn, author of Fatal System Error, The Hunt for the New Crime Lords Who Are Bringing Down the Internet. How much of a problem is this question that's been raised by Mark Rotenberg and indirectly by James Lewis as well? How difficult is this going to make it to protect the Internet against various kinds of crime?
No, the question of authentication, that's That is, I think scientists would agree, a doozy, if I could use some technical language. People have been working on this for a while. I agree it's a political problem as well as a technological problem. I think it's both. And, yeah, one of the big problems, free speech and other sort of worthy uses of anonymity is one issue. And another is the fact that, you know, as soon as you come up with something, there'll be, you know, pretty clever folks would find a way to get around it. I mean, that's why I think it's important that there are, test beds where they work on this stuff. The White House under cyber coordinator Howard Schmidt has come up with a sort of a voluntary authentication system. It hasn't gotten really any traction yet. I think they're reworking it. But the idea would be one of these opt-in things, so that if you want to do banking or something else and participate with some sort of biometric or some other system for authenticating who you are, then you can, but you don't have to. I think that would be a good idea, but you need there are a lot of things that have to come together, including maybe tax credits or some sort of R&D effort, some way to get businesses to participate in this, because right now it's not really worthwhile for businesses or for consumers to go for that kind of a system.
Now, Jim Lewis, what do you say to that?
No, I think that's right. We don't have much of a market incentive to do this. That doesn't mean that you won't eventually find situations where your bank may refuse to let you do some transactions online unless you have better ways to authenticate yourself, or your electrical company may not want you to be able to touch their systems unless you can authenticate yourself. So, you know, I think as we grow more and more dependent on these digital technologies, the need for authentication is going to grow. Whether we'll be able to solve that problem or whether we'll solve it here in the U.S. As opposed to some other country, I don't know. But I do know that it does become one of the requirements. It's not perfect, but it's one of the requirements for a more user-friendly internet.
There have been some interesting contradictions in terms of government policy. When China objected so much to Google, Hillary Clinton said that how wonderful it was that there was a technology whereby ordinary citizens could find out what their governments were doing, even in a repressive society like that. Then when WikiLeaks came along, she said that it was an attack on the entire international community. Jim Lewis, as you were writing cyberspace, securing cyberspace for the 44th presidency, did you have any policy guidelines to go by, or do we simply not have any yet?
Well, you know, one of the things you could do is you could ask yourself, look at the people who are pleased with WikiLeaks, and it includes those friends of freedom like Vladimir Putin, Fidel Castro, and the Iranian Republic. So it's not quite fair to equate Clinton and WikiLeaks. The policy guidelines we had were you have to think about the constitutional protections U.S. citizens have and how you need to adjust our laws and our policies to fit the new digital environment, something we've not yet been able to do.
Mark Rotenberg with the Electronic Privacy Information Center, what have you seen government trying to do in order to prevent not just the leaking of secrets that have to do with the military and international security and that sort of thing, but to prevent embarrassment of the sort that's happened with WikiLeaks?
Well, there are a whole range of activities, and I think several of them, in fact, have been accelerated as a result of WikiLeaks. So primary concern in Washington, which I know James is very familiar with, is the ongoing debate about cybersecurity authority. And there's a bit of a battle between the National Security Agency, which has traditionally been in the realm of intelligence gathering and surveillance, and the Department of Homeland Security, which has a somewhat more public-facing approach to computer security. And part of what you see in this battle between the NSA and the DHS are strategies that do reflect the cultures of the two agencies. So the NSA will say, for example, with regard to WikiLeaks, you know, greater secrecy, greater control, greater ongoing monitoring of the conduct of individuals. Homeland Security, I suspect, is more inclined to try to work in collaboration with U.S. business to look more toward open technical standard setting and a bit more buy-in from the user community. We, of course, I guess, would have a preference for the Homeland Security approach. Overall, it's one that's likely to be more accountable, but that doesn't necessarily answer the question, you know, which side wins out. I think when the Congress comes back in, however, you're going to see both of those views put forward pretty forcefully in terms of what has happened recently with WikiLeaks.
Jim Lewis, how secure are the Pentagon's websites? Obviously, when they shared with the State Department, I gather that's what happened with WikiLeaks. All of a sudden, there were a lot of people on the line, and they were open to a certain kind of attacks. But does the military have a separate secure networks that can't be penetrated?
Well, that's part of the problem. One of the things that happened in December of 2008 was that a foreign power was able to get onto CIPRNet, the secure network, and download a lot of material. The NIPRNet, the unclassified network, the DOD will tell you that the Chinese have been able to download between 10 and 20 terabytes. That's a little more than the entire Library of Congress. In this case, though, it wasn't an external opponent. What we did is we changed the rules to encourage information sharing after 9/11, and that was a good thing, but we didn't put in place new protections that would prevent someone from being able to download 250,000 cables onto a Lady Gaga CD. You know, it was the fact that we pursued information sharing to avoid future terrorist attacks, but we forgot to put in place the new digital technology. So step by step, we're getting there. But right now, I don't think anyone would say we're particularly secure.
Is the United States, the military, vulnerable to something like Stuxnet that could come into a system and actually cause hardware to be destroyed?
There's probably five or six militaries in the world that have the capability to design Stuxnet. And it wasn't really a big surprise because they've probably had these capabilities for 4 or 5 years. So this will be part of warfare in the future. It's another weapon system. People will use it when they think it's the right time.
Joseph Menn, the subtitle of your book is The Hunt for the New Crime Lords Who Are Bringing Down the Internet. What do you mean by bringing down the Internet? Is it threatened by these issues of security?
If by the Internet we mean the ability to watch skateboarding cats, then no, that's not going anywhere. A denial-of-service attack, a really, really big denial-of-service attack, could probably take out a Tier 1 service provider. It could take out...
What's that? What's a Tier 1 service provider?
Oh, your AT&Ts and your Verizons and so forth. But that's kind of, you know, worst-case scenario if all the criminals decided to get together and do something together one day. I don't think that's particularly likely. So the garden variety internet will be fine. But what I mean by that is that the way the internet has come to be used for government purposes, financial transactions, all that stuff is in very serious jeopardy. You won't find a lot of people talking about the vulnerability to Wall Street and the banks, but that there is a big concern about that. The amount of online fraud is going up dramatically, and we don't really know how big it is, but it's not getting better. I mean, the crimeware is where all the innovation is, just the way porn used to lead the way in terms of innovation. They've got really good capitalist diversification. They reinvest in their research and development, and they come up with new and better stuff. Tokens have been defeated. What's called out-of-band confirmation. For example, you're making a wire transfer from your business account and the bank has a system where they call your cell phone. That's beginning to be defeated. We have a very, very big problem, and it's only going in the wrong direction. That's what I mean by bringing down the internet.
Obviously, we're going to be talking about this for a long, long time. I want to thank you all for being on our program today. Joseph Menn, author of The Fatal System Error, covers the issue for Financial Times. Jim Lewis at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Securing Cyberspace for the 44th Presidency, a report you can download if you want. Mark Rotenberg at EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Thanks to you all, and thanks to our earlier guest, to Kevin Mitnick as well, with Mitnick Security Consulting. For 20 years, international policymakers have assumed that climate change would be the subject of a worldwide agreement. Key nations would agree to reduce greenhouse gases and trade carbon emissions in a common market. That vision is now a thing of the past. So what's next? A report on the UN Climate Conference in Cancun in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To The Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To The Point.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To The Point. I should say that NASA announced today that 2010 has been the hottest year on record. In the meantime, California businesses will pay to preserve tropical forests in Mexico and Brazil. Japan will help fund nuclear power plants in developing nations. South Korea will promote renewable energy at home. That's the new look for dealing with climate change, according to Juliet Alperin, who is covering the UN Climate Change Conference in Cancun. And Juliet Alperin, thanks as always for being on our program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sounds like you're having a little trouble with your phone at this point. Hopefully we can continue our conversation. What we're seeing, I take it, is instead of an overall treaty agreed to by many nations with the industrialized world assuming certain responsibilities and so on, instead of that, we've got a network of ad hoc arrangements.
Right. What they are still trying to do is establish a few rules that can govern, in fact, some of these more regional or individual bilateral arrangements. But you're really the model for, again, a couple of decades has been the idea that the entire world would come up with a strategy and everyone would do their part, a specific obligation to meet it. And that seems to be a thing of the past at this point. The leaders of the world simply can't agree on that.
How important is the United States to the decline of that vision of how things ought to be dealt with?
Well, they certainly are playing a role in that, partially because there's been such opposition domestically to both setting mandatory limits on greenhouse gases and the idea of ratifying an international treaty. This is something, the U.S. was one of the few industrialized nations that never ratified the Kyoto Protocol, the global pact that's still in existence from 1997. And right now they're taking a pretty hard line in the negotiations, really trying to press the major emerging economies like China and India to do more in order for the U.S. and others to both provide financing to poor countries and agree to a future round of emissions cuts.
Hasn't it also been very difficult for some nations who did agree to the Kyoto protocols, Canada and Britain included, to actually meet their obligations?
Yeah, Canada is the one that really stands out. Their emissions are now 30% higher than they were in 1990, which is the baseline that the world uses for the Kyoto Protocol. So that's a really vivid example of a developed nation that's simply unwilling to make the cuts that it had pledged in an international context. And in fact, that has helped kind of undermine momentum here because there's this real question about whether countries are willing to even deliver on their promises in a legal treaty.
And, of course, one of the things the United States objected to was that some of the fastest-growing countries, China and India particularly, refused to agree to try to control their emissions on the ground that the developed world caused the problem and that they have a right to catch up. Is that another factor that's led to what seems to be this change?
It is a factor, and actually one of the real sticking points that's going on right now is not even as much as India and China are taking some voluntary actions to reduce their emissions, but there's a real question of how much they will let the outside world scrutinize whether they are fulfilling those promises. And the U.S. has made it very clear that unless they can't reach an agreement on international scrutiny of the kind of voluntary cuts the developing world is making, that they simply won't sign off on things that, for example, more than 100 nations are calling for, things like billions of dollars a year to help the most vulnerable countries adapt with the climate impact we're already seeing, like sea level rise.
So if the international cooperation model seems to be failing, what are those concerned about climate change saying about the time frame? And will these separate arrangements between different countries be able to have an impact fast enough to actually make a difference?
that's a central question. I think there's no question that on some level the talks will continue, and there's talk about whether it's a year from now when there'll be talks in South Africa or beyond that, there'll still be an effort to reach some sort of global treaty. Whether that can happen or not remains in doubt. But a lot of the activity and the attention has shifted to these individual actions that countries and regions are making, like the ones you referenced. And one of the real outstanding questions is whether this kind of piecemeal global federalism approach can deliver on what everyone has kind of agreed, or many people agree, is a consensus target of keeping global temperatures rise no more than 2 degrees Celsius or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels. And as we're seeing from NASA today, temperatures continue to rise.
You're there for the Washington Post, but it seems to me there's been less coverage of Cancun than there was of Copenhagen a year ago. Is that your observation as well? Do you think there's just simply less interest?
Absolutely. I think there are fewer journalists who are here. I mean, it was absolutely packed in Copenhagen. That's not the case. Even many of the news organizations who are going have sent fewer people, although that's not the case with the Washington Post. And I think it's very hard to try to convey to readers why this still matters, given that we're talking about increasingly modest outcomes, with the real action taking place elsewhere than, here in the Yucatan.
Okay. Well, Juliet Alperin with the Washington Post in Cancun, thank you so much for being on our program.
Thanks so much, Warren.
Producers of To the Point, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Andrea Brody, Katie Cooper, Sonia Geis, Gary Scott, Technical Director Mike Newport, Managing Producer Cameron Radziner. Thanks to the John Coltrane family. Email us. Share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/to the point, and check us out on Facebook. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point. Produced live and podcast is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.